for scholarly and scientific publishing business models are shifting and changing as dramatically as snowdrifts in a blizzard. Now, research funding organizations, primarily in the UK and the US, but elsewhere in Europe and Asia as well, increasingly require unfettered access for the public to the research they have funded in academic laboratories. Failure to comply with such mandates puts future funding at risk. Yet without a flexible and friction-free infrastructure to collect article processing charges, so-called APCs, and deliver detailed reporting on those, authors and publishers face significant challenges. And if you've been following this story, you know what I'm talking about. And indeed, we've been sharing with you at Copyright Clearance Center a great deal of information about the changes underway in scholarly and scientific publishing as a result of these open access mandates. And Copyright Clearance Center has been assisting publishers in collecting author charges for almost a decade now. And along with the programs such as today's, the webinars that we have conducted over the last 2 years, it became clear to us that an open dialogue among publishers, institutions, and their vendors is essential to creating an efficient ecosystem for open access publishing. And to that point, in London at University College last October, Copyright Clearance Center brought together publishers and institutions for a roundtable discussion to share experiences and conceptualize possible solutions. Now, with regards to the institutional roundtable that was held in London in October, Copyright Clearance Center issued that group's finding in a report by Rob Johnson, the founder and director of Research Consulting. And the point there that we're going to stress throughout is that standards really matter. And to learn more about that, we want to invite onto the program Rob Johnson. And Rob, welcome. Rob Johnson, do we have you on our line?
Oh, yep. Can you hear me okay?
Indeed, we can. Rob Johnson, thank you so much for joining us from across the water there in the UK. Rob Johnson, welcome again. We've had you on several of our webinars throughout the last couple of years. We'll tell people briefly about your background. Rob Johnson is the founder and director of Research Consulting based in the UK. He's an experienced research manager and professional and chartered accountant. He founded Research Consulting early in 2013, indeed at the very beginning of this open access revolution. Previously, for the University of Nottingham, he served as research financial controller and subsequently head of research operations. So he is grounded in the institutional world and really knows a great deal about it as that's his native country, if you will. And Rob Johnson, it's great to have you back on the line here. And that institutional roundtable that we held in London at the University College brought together people not just from universities but from the publishing world as well. And we can see some of the names there. Tell us what it was like to have that group in a single room together.
Well, I think it was just a fantastic opportunity because, you were very kind in terms of what I know about open access, but I think we had much better authorities than me in the room, and my job was really just to tease out from them some of their experiences. So we had, as you say, some of the key people from publishers, so Brandon Nordine from American Chemical Society and Karen Hawkins from IEEE. We had Ros Pine from Nature Publishing Group, as well as some of your colleagues from CCC, Richard Wynn from Ares, and a number of people from institutions. And generally, these are people who are, I guess, right on the front line in grappling with open access and trying to make it work. And we had a really good mix of universities. So, Imperial College London, UCL, these are top institutions that will consistently figure in the top 10, top 20 world university rankings. And we also had smaller institutions. So I think we had a really good mixture of perspectives. And the value came, I think, in bringing those different stakeholders together to share their ideas, but also to find some of the common ways forward.
Indeed, and a couple of points about that. I mean, we have made a theme of these discussions with you and with others around open access that we hear you. We want to hear from people because open access really, we sounds dramatic, but it is radically rewriting the rules of scholarly and scientific publishing. And no single institution, no single publisher or intermediary has all the answers. It's really important to bring people together to share. And one of the things that's changing is the stakeholders, the people who are participating in this discussion. In the past, publishing, institutions were a customer of publishing. Now they really are much more closely to being partners, wouldn't you say, Rob?
Yes, absolutely. And I think we'll come on to talk about this. But the interactions are becoming much more complex with institutions and publishers. It's no longer just about the sort of annual subscription round, but actually almost on a day-to-day basis, there can be interactions between institutions and publishers and authors. And really the workflows for that are still evolving, and the whole environment is still evolving. So as you say, no one really has the answers, and that's because the questions keep changing at the moment.
Right, indeed. And when it comes down to that, let's talk about what the aims were for the day. There were a lot of questions. There was a lot of input from the participants, and you had some specific goals for that day.
That's right. I mean, as I say, part of it was really just about fostering dialogue between some of the stakeholders. So many people will know there's a lot of opportunities for librarians to get together. There's a lot of opportunities for publishers to get together. There perhaps aren't quite so many opportunities where publishers and librarians and vendors can get together in this sort of context and really grapple with some of the issues. So I think that was a great opportunity. And we used that to try to draw out some of the big challenges that that the different stakeholders are facing, to look at what vendors like CCC, like Ares, can do in providing solutions. And the other thing I encouraged people to do was to look at developing a future narrative on gold open access in particular. Now this concept of a future narrative comes from a professor at the University of Nottingham. So we have a chap called Chris Barnett there, who's a professor of strategy and future studies, which I think is just a fantastic job title. And he talks about this importance of, you know, when it comes to the future, either we just say, well, que sera, sera, there's nothing we can do, or we look at, well, what are the trends, what are the developments that we can see are happening, and construct a coherent narrative that takes account of those trends but starts to shape the way that we want the future to be. And that was really the idea of the round table, was to look at what's happening, to look at the challenges, but try to collectively agree on a narrative about how we move forward into the future from where we are now.
Right. And indeed, when it comes to the future, either you're in charge of the future or the future is in charge of you, I think.
Absolutely, yes. So it's it was about trying to recognize there's certain things we can do as a community of different stakeholders to set things up as well as we possibly can, given the changes that we're seeing.
Well, and at the end of that day, and it was a day, a pretty intensive day of discussions and breakout sessions and so forth, where did we wind up? Was there a sense that there was common ground possible here?
I think there was. So, I mean, afterwards, Jen Goodrich, who's the director of the Rights Link product at CCC, she and I were saying, I think what was fascinating was obviously there are differences of opinion sometimes between librarians and publishers around subscriptions and so on. But fundamentally, we found there was just a tremendous amount of commonality in the issues that people are facing. So ultimately, you know, whether it's publishers or institutions, they're trying to support authors, they're trying to get research out there, they're dealing with a very rapidly changing external environment, and they're often doing that within, you know, resource constraints with systems that perhaps aren't designed to do what they're now being asked to do. So I think we did find a lot of agreement, and far more agreement than disagreement over the course of the day.
And what's interesting about that, Rob Johnson, is that we've been talking about these issues now for a couple of years, and there seems to have been an evolution, a progression from, oh, this is revolutionary, this is really turning the tables on publishing, to a sense among the different communities, the authors, the publishers, indeed even the funders and the institutions, that frankly what we're talking about is something we've been working with in scholarly publishing for 300 years. It's a business. There needs to be business transactions. There need to be business processes that can handle this change. But this is not really all that different than what publishers have done for so many years.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's just it's perhaps just changing the order in which things happen. It's it's changing the nature of the customer and how the customer perhaps pays for things. But you're right, there is an element of evolution in here as well as revolution. And of course, what we're seeing is many publishers making a gradual transition towards open access over time and testing things and finding out what works rather than having to completely overturn the apple cart and start again.
And Rob, you've spoke about the changing roles and the changing places of these various stakeholders within this ecosystem, and it's certainly clear to everyone when it comes to open access that authors and engaging authors appropriately and serving them sufficiently and efficiently is crucial to success here. But again, this is a very complex process. It's a change that is perhaps still in the early stages. Tell us about the discussion at the roundtable around this particular point and what were some thoughts that people had that are really important takeaways to share with our audience.
Well, I think this whole question of author engagement is a really interesting one because I think everyone recognizes we want authors to be at the center of the process, but also they need support and they need guidance. So while no one really wants to exclude them from it, often there are some things that authors will struggle to get to grips with or may not have enough time to get to grips with, and that's where potentially librarians, research managers, institutions and publishers can help alleviate that burden a little bit. And what we see is it's just a very, very complex environment. So when we have publications that arise from multiple funding sources, and obviously authors are publishing potentially with more than one publisher, with different policies, and they may have co-authors who are also subject to different institutional mandates, potentially different funder mandates, actually making sense of that is extremely complex. And so I think the days when effectively the author could just interact with the publisher and it was a purely two-way relationship, that those are going, and increasingly authors need input and assistance from their institution, from administrators up front. And so what we talked about, I think, was that the publishers recognize that too, that actually in cases where institutional administrators haven't been involved, that's where things can tend to go wrong, and often they get involved later on. So I think one of the things that, say, Karen Hawkins was saying is they recognize they've got to start to find ways of engaging actively with institutional librarians from the outset, because often they're the ones who are best informed about licensing, they understand what funder requirements are, and they can guide the author through the process as effectively as possible.
Well, that's fascinating because, you know, I was setting up this two-way communication, author and publisher, but really there's three-way, four-way. It's a multiverse of discussions that go on.
That's right. And we also had some very interesting discussions about, you know, where does the open access workflow start? So historically, really, institutions wouldn't get involved until the point of publication and beyond. But now we're talking about actually at the point of acceptance, even at the point of submission and choosing where authors wish to publish, there may be a role for institutions to play. And of course, this gets into some tricky territory, because what most institutions don't want to be doing is dictating where authors publish. They want to allow them the freedom to publish in the best journal, but to do so from an informed position of understanding what the mandates are and how they can achieve compliance if they possibly can without compromising the best choice of journal.
Yeah, indeed. And you mentioned workflow there, and that's critical. When do people become involved? At what stage does an intermediary solution really need to begin to handle a transaction? How does notification get made and so forth? You could construct a kind of Rube Goldberg machine, but that's probably not what anyone in this ecosystem really wants to see. They want to see as much as possible a frictionless process, right?
Yeah, that's right. And we had some people that had done a lot of thinking about this. So Graham Stone of the University of Huddersfield, some people may have seen, he's done some great work with Jill Emery of Portland State in the US, setting up a wiki of open access workflows for academic librarians. So he talked very much about this concept of sticking points in the process. And some of that comes because as soon as people think they've got a workflow set up, something else happens that changes it. So in the UK, it's perhaps been about our more recent developments around our research excellence framework, where authors have to deposit their manuscript on the acceptance for publication in the repository. And that requires a lot of changes. But I think the consensus around the process and streamlining it was really about scalability. So both institutions and publishers need a process that can scale. So several people were saying, well, we're coping at the moment, you know, we can manage at the level of activity we have, but we know that the processes, the systems we've got, rely on a lot of manual intervention, and as volumes rise, that's not going to become scalable. So I think that's where potentially intermediaries, new systems, new ways of working can start to lift that burden. So as scale increases, the case for that sort of solution gets stronger.
Open access is rewriting the rules of relationships, right? It sounds like a lifestyle magazine we're talking about here, but really the rules of relationships are changing externally. The authors, the publishers, the institutions, the funders have a different place in this ecosystem. But what the discussions you conducted at the Institutional Roundtable revealed was that there are also new relationships internally. So whether it's inside a publishing organization, inside a library, inside research offices, there are changes that are going on internally as well as externally.
That's right. I found that in my old job at the University of Nottingham, I suddenly started to have a lot more contact with librarians when open access came onto the scene, because it's a sort of interaction between the inputs to the research process in terms of funding and grants and the outputs in terms of publication. And those have almost been never the twain shall meet in the past. And now there's much more emphasis on linking the two up. And that requires research offices and librarians to work much more closely together. But actually within publishers, as you say, it's also a similar situation. So Brandon Nordine was making the point that actually they've had to get their finance and operations staff at ACS much more closely involved with the production and editorial teams, because the nature of the open access process is that payment and finance is inherently part of that production workflow in a way that it never was under a subscription model. So these new relationships are being formed, you're right, both between stakeholders but also within the organizations themselves.
And there's a greater reliance than ever. I mean, you were referring a bit to sort of handling the complexities of this. It's the information systems, the technology that ultimately is going to be our salvation in all of this, right?
Well, yes, I think that's true. But I think obviously most organizations, large organizations, have existing technology systems, and often what they're finding is they're trying to use those to meet the requirements of open access, and they're not necessarily designed to do that. And of course, adopting a new system or commissioning substantial changes, you know, I've talked a lot to librarians and publishers, and this is not an easy thing to do. So there's certainly the prospect of tremendous advances, but I think for individual organizations, actually commissioning the sort of changes, working out what's required, and often, you know, for publishers, continuing to obviously manage their subscriptions business at the same time means this is a difficult solution to reach just at the moment.
Indeed, and we'll be hearing more about the data challenge there. Well, we're chatting right now with Rob Johnson from Research Consulting, taking a look at the findings of a discussion we called an Institutional Roundtable that Copyright Clearance Center organized in London back in the fall. Our report has now been issued. You can get that online at copyright.com/open-access. Rob Johnson, It may perhaps strike people as surprising in a world of so-called open access that copyright and licensing are still important to the process and still very much a key to success here. And when it comes to copyright, I'm fond of saying that if you're confused, you're beginning to understand the problem. And when it comes to these authors contributing to scholarly scientific society journals, they're not always familiar with the kinds of license options and the requirements of funders, are they?
That's right, yes. And we did have some really interesting discussions about this because I think fundamentally a lot of the funders, particularly in the UK, but also in the US, for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have started to require a CC BY attribution license, so a very permissive license. And I think authors, in many cases, are quite concerned at the implications of this, and publishers are keen to preserve author choice, potentially. And so we had some very interesting discussions around this, and I think something that was really enlightening was Ros Pyne at Nature Publishing. We timed this very well because they just announced that Nature Communications was becoming a fully open access journal and CC BY by default. And she shared some of their thinking behind that. And what they had done is they'd done an experiment where they looked at the order of the license options they presented to authors, and they switched those around just to see what happened. And what they found was, regardless of what order they were presented in, authors just picked the middle option. So what that said was authors weren't necessarily that well informed on the implications of their choices. And the other test they did was to switch to CC BY as a default license for a period of time. And again, they found that only a tiny minority, only 3% of authors actually said, no, I don't want CC BY, I want something else, in which case they were more than happy to accommodate that. So I think there's quite a lot of inertia and quite a lot of misunderstanding about licensing. So this is an area where it certainly pays to think about what options are being presented to authors, what road they are perhaps being pushed down, even just in the order and the default options that are presented.
Right. And, you know, Rob Johnson, there's something charming and very revealing about this point that authors always chose the middle ground. There's been some characterization of some of the research authors in this community as sort of, you know, being evangelists for open access. And what that seems to tell me is that, that most of these authors want to take literally the middle ground. They're more comfortable in that space than they might be on the edges.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are, of course, some members of the academic community who are tremendous and very, very powerful advocates for open access. There are others who are really very concerned about it. They're often concerned about the impact on learned societies, for example, of disrupting the subscription model. But you're right, for an awful lot of authors, I think we have to remember, you know, this is a fairly small part of what they do. Actually, what they're doing is the research. This is the mechanism by which they disseminate the research they've already done. And they have students to teach. They may be under pressure to engage with business. They have administrative responsibilities internally. So like all of us, if it just becomes another task, another thing to understand, they will inevitably take perhaps the path of least resistance.
And really coming to the close on this review of the roundtable and its findings, Rob Johnson, what I think is lying again at the center of all of this is this recognition that open access is not going away, that the volume of article processing charges incoming to publishers is going to continue to rise. It's rising dramatically. There are some numbers out there which show tremendous growth from a base of very low base, nevertheless, but still dramatic, sharp incline, and to continue for some time to come. So this really challenges publishers to take a serious look at how they're going to manage that.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that the consensus on the day was that billing individually for every APC just doesn't make sense for anyone in this process. So when we start to talk about thousands of APCs, that's just too much paperwork, it's too much inefficiency and scope for things to go wrong. But I think what we did find is that institutions really want to preserve some transparency in the process. So they're happy to make a large payment in respect of APCs, but they want to understand exactly what it's cost them per APC. And they don't necessarily want to see a return to something akin to the big deal model that's used for subscriptions. Whereas I think for publishers, the challenge for them is just the complexity of billing for APCs, because there are so many variables, because they might have waivers, there can often be different taxation regimes, there may be discounts that are applied. People may have society memberships, which means they pay a different rate. So actually working out what to charge in each case can become quite a complex, time-consuming process. So all of this is adding additional layers of administration into the open access process that weren't there in a subscription model.
Right. And, you know, the point there is you mentioned taxes, you mentioned certain kinds of discounts that might be based on an author's country of origin, for example. There's various memberships and others, other considerations to be made. This is really a global issue. I mean, you were there in London. Open access has been driven in part by the mandates issued by the UK government and by funders based in the UK like Wellcome Trust. The U.S. is not far behind in all of that. But in recent months, we've seen open access mandates coming from disparate places as China and across Europe, in South America, and so forth. So really, obviously, too, research is conducted around the world at universities and offices on every continent. So really, this is a global challenge, and that just is. Means that it's as complex as the world is.
Well, that's right. I mean, I happened to be in the Middle East a couple of weeks ago, and actually they've perhaps been slower than other parts of the world, but there's already been enough starting to see institutional mandates. So I think the first couple of institutional mandates have now been adopted by universities in Saudi Arabia. There are funders introducing open access mandates. And I was talking to some North African institutions, and open access presents some great opportunities and some great challenges for them, because in many cases they can't afford subscriptions. So actually making things open access will greatly increase the volume of research their researchers can make use of. But when it comes to publishing, if it's a case of paying to publish, then that's potentially a very big barrier for them. So there's lots of, ongoing challenges, and I don't think things are going to get any easier anytime soon. But this is something that is on the radar for people all over the world. There's often a particular national complexity or character to it, but this is a global movement, absolutely.
Indeed. And so that colleague of yours suggests that we need to have a future narrative. And so at the end of this day of discussions at this institutional roundtable, everyone participated in trying to write a future narrative. Tell us where this leads us.
Well, I think this is a fantastic way of articulating what we're aiming for, and I think this just illustrates that point about there is a huge amount of common ground. So actually, publishers and librarians, research support managers, and vendors were all happy that this was something they could buy into. So it's got to be a sustainable OA ecosystem. It's got to be scalable, as we said. But fundamentally, we want to preserve author, academic freedom, author choice, and actually make the research as valuable as possible for the end user. And I think what you'll come on to talk to Helen about, I know, is this point about simplifying and standardizing processes. And I think when it comes to how do we move forward from here, that's probably the biggest thing that can be done in the near future is getting some standards, getting some standardized processes that will help streamline all of this activity, and that will support that scalability.
Well, indeed. Well, Rob Johnson from Research Consulting in the UK, thanks for that, and appreciate your good work in that institutional roundtable. Please stand by. And right now, though, we want to introduce to our audience Helen Henderson, the Managing Director of Information Power. Helen, welcome to our webinar today.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Well, it's good to have you join us today. We appreciate having you here because, we've been hearing Rob Johnson recount the conversations that went on at the Institutional Roundtable, and it's an opportunity for people to, as he described, envision a future narrative, and people can envision whatever they want. You've been involved in really crafting reality out of that vision, and we'll tell people about your background briefly. You've enjoyed a varied professional life, starting as a geologist and then working mainly in the commercial sector as a librarian, software developer, publisher, and subscription agent. You were the founder of Ringgold, which now provides an authoritative database of institutional subscribers to publishers worldwide. Your company, which you co-founded, Information Power, has developed a database of customer information for publishers that now forms the basis for potential standards of all kinds. And you work on several standards committees, including the National Information Standards Organization's Institutional Identifiers Working Group, and they probably have an abbreviation for that. I hope they do, but that is NISO's Institutional Identifiers Working Group. So really somebody who gets standards and gets identifiers particularly, and I guess one of the things that you're here to tell us about is that these things take time.
Yes, indeed. I mean, we look at this timeline, but in fact, I mean, one of the first people to identify the need for identifiers was Derek de Solla Price in 1963, and he said basically that we'll never get anywhere unless all our metadata can be identified with unique identifiers. So that goes back a long way. I mean, I really got involved in the 80s, but in terms of the institutional identifiers, the first discussions we had were in 1996, when the publishers were first putting up their full text. And the publishers suddenly realized, hang on, we have no idea who's looking at our content anymore. We don't have a subscription list. All we know is their IP addresses. So shouldn't we be able to actually have an identifier that says, this is the institution, this is who they are, and this is what their IP address range is? And that was a great idea, but unfortunately, one of the key things about standards is you have to have a business case and you have to have a business model, because they often cost a lot of money to implement. So nothing really happened until I was working with OCLC, where they were trying to put together a rights management system. In other words, to know which institutions had which rights, so people could get to the data they were entitled to without having to go through a whole password sign-on authentication process. That if you picked up a citation and you had the rights to the full text, you could be put straight through to it.
Right. In a sense, what you're describing is a kind of all-access pass.
Exactly. But, of course, you have to know what people have bought in order to do that. It was a great idea, but nobody could really see the business model for it. In other words, it was going to cost money, but could it be sustainable? And this is a big issue with standards, is how do you make them sustainable? So I was working with Oxford University Press on they put in a new customer and subscription management system, and they suddenly realized, hang on, we've got about 1 million records within our organization, all of which are saying, about people. I'm sure there aren't 1 million institutions actually, who are customers. Let's try and actually allocate all these records to institutions so we know, first of all, what the subscription is that each institution is paying. Because, of course, this was the beginning of the whole site licensing, and they wanted to know, what subscriptions does this institution already have? So what we did was we took all that data and we munged it, to use a technical term, to actually allocate it to the individual institutions. And as part of this, we said, we've got to give each institution an identifier so that we can then use that across the different databases that they contain their information. So we did this and we created metadata for each of these identifiers, because an identifier is no use without metadata. And then once we'd done this for them, three or four other publishers came along and said, oh, that's good, can you do it for us as well? So all of a sudden, we had about 10 publishers who were all using the same identifiers and the same metadata in their internal systems. So you could see we're beginning to establish a standard. And so what happened was we created this database, which basically had the institutional identifier, the institute, and enough metadata to say, this is this institution. Because, of course, when you're working in a global field, there are many institutions with the same name. And, for example, how many Loyola universities are there in the US? I believe there's 5. So you need to have something to say, it's this Loyola. So we basically created a database and made it available for people to actually look up their own identifiers. One of the funny side things of this was people came, wrote back to us and said, hang on, no, you've got, we're not in this town, we're in that town. You've got it wrong, your metadata's wrong, which was great, because that's what you need, is people to feed back. At one point, we had 70 people worldwide working on this database, because you needed somebody who was familiar with the institutions and the structures of the institutions in practically every country in the world. So in 2005, we merged with another technology company to create Ringgold. And at that point, you know, the database grew. We took on many, many more publishers. And it became a sort of de facto standard. But the reason it succeeded is because we had a business model. Basically, the publishers were paying us to create and maintain that standard. And this is rare, actually, to have a business model like that for a standard. And because it was the only real standard in the area, we then became one of the first ISNI registration agencies and the first for institutions. And really, when we came to coming into open access, it's because, of course, you know, people want to know which institution is this author coming from. And so within that, and particularly with ORCID, ORCID is adopted identifier. So with if you have an ORCID ID, then you can have an organizational ID as well. So we're now getting into the idea that, you know, we can mechanize, because you can only mechanize if you have absolutely consistent names for everything. So we know the name of the author and we know the name of the institution. But if you look at the timeline, it takes a long time and there are a lot of people involved, and trying to get consensus is extremely difficult.
Well, indeed. And, you know, Helen Henderson, co-founder of Ringgold, co-founder of Information Power, I guess beyond the point that these things take time, your other message is stick to it. And so I want to go on to look at why this matters, particularly with open access. We sort of set that up with Rob Johnson's discussion. But when it comes to identifying authors and institutions properly and correctly, you mentioned Loyola's. How many Trinity colleges are there? There's numerous Trinity colleges, even in the U.S. And I could think of Dublin and many other examples too. But what this matters in open access is it will come down to how much should an author be charged, if they should be charged at all, how should all of that be reported. And you know, Copyright Clearance Center sees the importance of this. We just announced last fall our own integration with Ringgold, because what we understand is that as that author information is coming into us through RightsLink for Open Access, we need to be sure that they're charged properly and that these calculations are made according to whatever the deals are that pre-exist. And this then frees up institutions to not be concerned about it. They're just relying upon that database to do all this correctly. So there are a variety of elements. We've mentioned Ringgold. You refer to ORCID. You might tell people a bit briefly about that. But as we can see here, Rob Johnson wasn't kidding us. This is complex.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, ORCID, again, is an initiative to try and make sure that all researchers have a unique ID, which means that they can follow their work through the various aspects. For example, you know, if you have a publisher can embed an ORCID in citations, it means that you can link directly, you can click on that author, and you can immediately go to all the other work that they've published, you know, regardless of where it's published, you know, what institution they've published it with, you know, what funder it is. It comes back to the whole linking process and the ability to use a piece of information once and have it linked throughout. And this comes back to the whole linked data concept.
Beyond ORCID and Ringgold, though, I mean, DOI is something which is rather like the experience you had with Ringgold. There was talk as long ago as 12 years, maybe longer, regarding this digital object identifier. And at the time, in the early days, it seemed sort of way off in the distance that this would be adopted. Now we see great success around all of that. And, of course, FundRef, development of CrossRef, likewise, is really beginning to take hold. And to your point around the need for business cases and business models, there's a certain momentum around all of this. But as a final question, you know, it must be difficult convincing publishers. I think vendors get it. Are publishers now increasingly understanding the importance of all these metadata standards and identifiers?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I mean, I was talking to somebody at OUP, and they said, you know, when we first started talking to you, you know, 10, 12 years ago, you know, what the situation we're in now would be nirvana. You know, we can't believe we've actually got to that stage. And I have to say, publishers have always been extremely supportive of standards because it makes their life so much easier. I mean, certainly all these standards, you know, ORCID, DOI, you know, the publisher are people pushing those. They really are, because it makes their life so much easier. And I think, you know, that's something I'm not sure all the institutions realize, is that it tends to be the publishers that fund the standards.
Indeed. Well, Helen Henderson, thank you for the contribution and sort of bringing a little bit of reality and a nice history to this story of standards and their desirability within the open access environment. And I want to thank those panelists who joined us today for our program. Rob Johnson, Director of Research Information, thank you.
Thank you.
Helen Henderson, also in the UK, Managing Director of Information Power and co-founder of Ringgold. Great to have you on the program, Helen. Thank you.
Thank you.
For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, my name's Chris Keneally. Thank you for joining us. And do follow us at copyright.com/open access for all the latest news. Take care.